it's civil war level division in the country right now. And the vigor with which people embrace falsehoods and conspiracies really frightens me. That's the core issue. And that is what informs how people choose their president.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was really glad to have the chance to talk Trump and journalism with Carol Lenig. Carol is a national investigative reporter for The Washington Post, currently covering the Trump administration, and co-author of the recent bestseller, A Very Stable Genius, Donald Trump's Testing of America. She's won Pulitzer Prizes and Polk Awards, and I'm glad she's not currently investigating me. Beyond that, she's a friend and neighbor, and I see her on TV from time to time. Carol and I had a good conversation about her book and the character of Donald Trump. After more than 200 interviews with people who've worked with him and her regular reporting, she knows a great deal. You should listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Carol Lenig of The Washington Post.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Carol, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
No problem. I'm Carol Lenig. I'm a reporter at the Washington Post. I've worked there for 20 years and a few months, and I mostly write about the Trump White House now. I've covered lots of different things. I grew up in Maryland and went to school in Philadelphia and then worked in North Carolina, eventually came back to cover Congress in Washington and then began working for the Post.
So just to delve into that a little bit, you say you grew up in Maryland. Both parents were lawyers?
Yeah, my father was a lawyer before I was born, and my mother went to law school when I went to college.
Was it a political household? Did that sort of the training your parents have affect you and how you think? Of course it did, but...
Absolutely. I think about the kinds of conversations we had at the dinner table, even though we were little. We were presumed to be mini adults. We were expected to sort of be able to hold our own in conversation, and it was a nice training for being able to articulate an argument and summon a set of facts. Facts were important. I also remember, you know, just funny things like you had to kind of make a legal argument to my father when you made a request for money. And it was just a funny thing about gathering the right facts to explain why you really needed this and it was important.
Things like that really do train the brain. You said school in Philadelphia, but that's Bryn Mawr College outside Philadelphia, right?
That's right.
How was that for you?
You know, in many ways, it was not the perfect place for me. And in other ways, it was such a gift to go there. I remember my grandmother being really excited when I got accepted to school there because she was a very unusual woman in her time. She was a person who went to college at Cornell when almost no women went to college. And so she was pretty excited for me to go to this school that she knew well. Being an all-women's college wasn't really what I was looking for. I think I was looking for a more traditional rah-rah college experience, but it ended up being really a great training ground because it was presumed that women would do everything and do anything. And so you know, I became eventually the editor of our college newspaper, and I'm not sure if I had gone to a co-ed school that I would have had that automatic expectation for myself that I would lead, you know, a major institution on the college, but I did.
What kind of editor were you for that newspaper?
I think I was probably not perfect. I was learning. I was interested in story, and I was interested in accountability. It will sound sexist, but when you are a woman, I think you gravitate towards information that's told in a narrative form. You get invested in the characters. You have a pathos and a sympathy. I know this is an overwhelming stereotype, but I think that women enter news often in a different way than men do. And so as an editor at the paper, I remember being captivated by and assigning stories that were about human beings and how that reflected something larger or something problematic or something interesting, that the characters were what I wanted to know more about to tell the story.
And I guess whenever you're telling a story, you can write it about the characters and their motivation, like you would write a novel or something, or you could write it much more about, I don't know, the mechanisms and the power and things like that. It seems like that's reflected in your recent book, that interest in the characters.
Yes, but it's been, you know, obviously an evolution in my career, because I remember when I started at the Post, a very helpful and caring editor said to me, "I feel like you're writing an indictment." I had gathered all my facts, just as I had for my father, you know, standing on the rug to make my argument for why I needed this $50 or this $22 or whatever it was. I was gathering my facts just like a prosecutor did, of why this is a problem. Here's the issue. As time went on, I got better at telling the story and intertwining the facts. In A Very Stable Genius, our book, which I wrote with my colleague, great colleague, Phil Rucker, we started out feeling like facts were absolutely essential because he so often dismisses and undermines them. So our facts were critical and we gathered them with precision and care. But our frame was really, who is this man? What motivates this character, this president like no other? How can we, with our facts, show you what he's like and sort of show you what makes him tick?
In the beginning of the book, you talk about yourselves as objective journalists. And it's an interesting line to walk, I think. Obviously, you're professional at doing that. But how, when you're constructing a narrative about this president, do you keep yourself within certain boundaries of what you think your profession ought to do?
It's such a good question, Nathaniel, because I've thought a lot about how this president has sort of shaken up everything. He is a president like no other that I've experienced in my professional career. And he challenges all norms. He doesn't feel any shame about ad hominem attacks on vicious language to people, even in his own party. He doesn't feel that it's important to be consistent and truthful from day to day, even when we face as a nation a lot of crises at the moment. So it is challenging sometimes when you look at that and say to yourself, am I being too hard on this person? Am I going overboard in explaining who he is? But the honest truth is, I'm doing the same things I've always done in my career and Phil and I have always done, which is we let the facts speak for themselves. And in the case of President Trump, that often is not very flattering. That often is a pretty devastating portrait when you just lay out what happened.
I read the book, and the stories that you choose to tell, almost all of them make him look bad. Did you miss some stories about when he looks good? There's like a paragraph or two about passing the First Step Act, which, you know, which is almost like a transition between two bad stories. But here he got some bipartisan achievement, which I think he's later sort of wished he hadn't done or something. But like, is there another account of his presidency that's more positive?
I completely can envision that we missed some important, interesting stories, maybe that were more flattering. It's very possible. We set out basically to ask every source that would talk to us and convinced many to talk to us who absolutely refused at the beginning. We set out to just ask them, what happened in this presidency? What did you see? And this is what came back in the fishing lure. I want to emphasize that in the more than 200 people that we interviewed, the overwhelming number of them were people who worked for Donald Trump and sought out a job working for him or advising him or befriending him. Many of them were people who wanted to see their own agenda and his agenda accomplished. And so they were fans of his and supporters of his, at least at the start. One feature and theme of the reporting is that so many of the people we interviewed began feeling like they could bring normalcy and rhythm and order to a sometimes impulsive and reckless businessman who was used to making decisions by himself and on the fly. And over time, they really soured, not because they weren't being listened to, but because they realized there was something bigger afoot than impulse and chaos, that many of the decisions the president made were not in the best interest of the country, but in the best interest of his momentary hope for winning the news cycle or winning re-election or beating back a Twitter enemy, that kind of thing. Many of the folks that we spoke to had such high hopes for this presidency and found them dashed.
Are there any things that you admire about the president?
I try not to think about presidents in my work as admirable or detestable. Again, I hate to be such a nerd, but I don't think of it that way. But I'll answer your question another way and say that I am incredibly impressed by his showmanship and his marketing skills. This is a president who has been able to boil things down in incredible sound bites that have resonated and become part of the reflexive parlance of large parts of our country. You know, the phrase, it's a hoax. You hear that so often now, and it's drilled in by the president himself. It's a disgrace. Anybody who's questioning him or investigating him, it is a disgrace. Those are also drilled in. He is able to, even though he changes his story, an account of events over and over again, he's able to, with his marketing skills, convince people that what he's saying that moment is true. I find that an amazing skill. I'm not sure it's that good for the country. In fact, I think it's quite dangerous, but it is a skill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi once said in a shout out with the president in a private meeting back in 2019, you know, I wish you were a politician. And in his marketing skills, he is a politician.
What do you worry the most about with this president in the remaining months that he has before he's standing for re-election?
There is quite a lot to worry about. I think the president has basically told us, it's not even him telegraphing it anymore, but he's told us that he is very likely not going to accept the results of the election if it tilts against him. And because he's a president who's really without the ability to be shamed, without the ability to feel the normative feelings of, well, I've lost fair and square, I should step away from the stage, that is not Donald Trump, I fear what he will do with the tools at his disposal if the election doesn't go his way. I'm also anxious as a member of society watching the incendiary nature of the federal response to protests around the country. It feels like a curtain raiser for the potential for martial law in our country if he doesn't like something else. Our great colleagues at the Post recently reported in the last few days that the president sought out this federal response and asked Attorney General Bill Barr to send troops to these places because he basically wants good camera roll for how vicious he views the protesters in Chicago or Portland or Seattle. He wants it for part of his video for campaigns and to show people that he's the law and order president who's protecting them from this menace. I fear if that's his motive and goal, what will he do with the forces at his disposal if he's told you haven't won the election?
So there's the fear of what he does after the election. And as you sort of alluded to, there's this preparation of a law and order events, kind of like he did with in the run-up to the midterm with a caravan. What other things do you see as percolating? I think of the Obamagate investigation. What else do you think is kind of being lined up to be useful to him in the fall?
The Obamagate elements are still sort of percolating. You know, the case against Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, who he once said he had to fire because Flynn lied to the vice president. Well, now the president says Michael Flynn's a hero and it was treated very badly. That case is still moving forward, in which a circuit court will decide whether or not a trial judge should be allowed to decide whether Flynn's case should really be dismissed. You'll remember Michael Flynn basically lied to FBI agents. He may be the first person that I know of who the attorney general intervened to say that lying to FBI agents was not material or relevant. I don't know of a case like that. There may be one. But Michael Flynn is critical to the president's publicity campaign to say that a deep state was out to get him, spying on his national security advisor even before he became president and was inaugurated. But I'm going to turn the tables a little bit, Nathaniel, and say there are things to be anxious about that the president may or may not do and that he's hinted he might do. But rather than speculate about that, I think it might be worthwhile saying that many of the sources we spoke to for our book had a much bigger fear about the president. They had worked for him. They had seen how he operated. And what they were most worried about was the way in which he had been successful in weakening, you know, institutions that had been stalwarts of independence, of objectivity, and of transparency. The Department of Justice, if you have any friends who are prosecutors in the Department of Justice, you know that many of them come into work every day wondering, should I quit? This place is not the blind and objective institution that I joined. I've heard so many people that I used to cover in that department really despondent about the way in which the president has been able to tilt that department in his direction. Often, I would imagine, because Bill Barr believes that the president's right, believes that there is a deep state, believes that the president should have much broader powers, and that the FBI should never be investigating a incoming president's campaign, even if it does look like they're inviting Russian interference in an election. There's also the institutions that we hold dear in the Defense Department. You'll remember General Mattis came out recently with the clearing of Lafayette Square on June 1. And General Mattis, who had been really silent about President Trump and repeatedly telling all sorts of reporters, including me, that, you know, he just couldn't openly criticize a current president. It was not the time. But the time came when the president used the defense secretary, Mark Esper, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, in a photo op to show that he was the boss and ordered, with Bill Barr's help, the forcible clearing of a group of peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square. You'll remember Milley was in these combat fatigues. Esper and he were flanking the president as he walked across Lafayette Square to a church to hold a Bible. The president doesn't go to church, doesn't know much that's in the Bible, but it was an important photo op, and it was a video that the White House released to show the president's strength. Mattis's reaction captures the reaction of many military leaders. The general came out with a letter basically saying, this is a president who seeks to divide us. And he was revolted by the use of the military and the Defense Department to seemingly sanction that abuse of protesters.
Well, I have to confess that when you're the way you describe that, that I get that kind of chill down my back about the threat to the democracy that he poses. I haven't had that about a previous president. I haven't liked a bunch of them, but there's something different going on here, isn't there?
Absolutely, there's something different going on here. I'll tell you an experience, and it's a bit of a nerdy journalist one, in that it's sort of behind the scenes in my job, and I hope that people who listen will understand. But there is a whole universe of people who serve a president, who are in the intel world, in the national security world, and they view their job as a sacred public duty. And many of them are pretty conservative. That's, again, a stereotype, but many of them are pretty conservative in their political leanings. And one thing, whether they're Democrat or Republican or independent, that they hold dear is that their duty is to the Constitution, but they also have a kind of special bond with the current administration and the president. And that bond is a promise that they will keep secret the private discussions that happen in the White House, that those things should stay in the White House because the president should have the opportunity to do his job and deal with incredibly sensitive national security matters, foreign diplomacy, covert operations. He should be allowed to do that work without a lot of prying eyes and criticism and potential threats of key sources and methods being revealed. But in this presidency, for the first time, those individuals were coming to talk to me, because while in their whole lives they had run screaming from journalists, respectfully, this time they found the same chill up their spine, the same shudder. I remember with a bit of a halting breath that this one source who came to me, who should not have in any normal presidency been speaking to a journalist, and basically said, I fear what is going to happen to our country if this man is allowed to continue to weaken our institutions. You know, how low is he going to lower the bar? And will it weaken us to the degree that we can't come back? I'm paraphrasing that person, of course, but it was chilling to sit with that person and hear their experience and the wake-up call that they felt they were getting on a daily basis working near the White House and seeing what the president was doing, that sort of, I don't know, rushed that person into my arms, so to speak.
I'm curious how you think about that subject of people talking out of school or leaking. It seems like it must be, to a large degree, the bread and butter of your work, finding ways to elicit information from these people. And yet there is a reasonable sense that people ought to keep their counsel private and keep some of these scenes from coming out. What's the balance there? And how do you think about what's right from the perspective of someone on the inside talking about what's going on to someone like you?
I feel like there is a judgment by the president that leaks that are unflattering to him are leaks, you know, that there's this moralistic kind of claim. I've even had, you know, the press secretaries say to me, how can you believe or trust someone so dishonorable to leak information to you? You know, why in the world would you invest any credit or trust in such a person who had such low morals? Well, I think of just dozens of examples when people were sharing information with me as a whistleblower would share their outrage that this was happening and the public might never find out. I don't think of those as leaks per se, though the president calls them. The word leak sounds so repugnant, like you're running around sharing classified information and putting our soldiers at risk. You're dishing on someone to make them look bad. Well, the president has done that himself. The president has leaked things to make it appear in a news story that he's to be credited for something more than he is. Jared and Ivanka have been accused multiple times credibly of having their spokespeople leak things to make them look better in a story than one of their foes, whether it be Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, or Chief of Staff John Kelly. I'll give you one of the examples where someone leaked something to me, and it was with outrage. It was one of those dozens of examples. National security and intelligence and foreign diplomatic experts in our government were consistently appalled by the president's naive acceptance of everything that Vladimir Putin told him in private phone calls. So many of them were outraged and kept the counsel for months and months and months. And one day, the president was begging his national security advisor to be able to call Vladimir Putin and congratulate him on his recent reelection. As you probably know, the United States had concluded, the United States intelligence community had concluded that Vladimir Putin had rigged that election to be reelected, had used all the state tools at his disposal to disadvantage his two opponents and to keep one of them from even being on the ballot. So the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, warned the president privately, you know, I don't think you should be calling him and congratulating him on an election that we question. It is not a democratic election. It doesn't look good for the United States. If it leaks that you congratulated him, you know, you will be parodied or you will be questioned. Again, not his exact words, but close. And the president said, no, 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 I want to do it. So the National Security Advisor instead suggested maybe they should do the call and the president should try to accomplish some tasks. And he gave him some talking points. In all caps, in small cards that the president was given before the call, he was told, do not congratulate Putin on his election. Do not use the word congratulate. The first thing the president did on the call was congratulate Vladimir Putin on the call, on his election. And people were just outraged that he would do exactly what was counter to his own reputation, to the advice of the experts, and once again, sort of show his naivete and put the U.S. in a bad position. So they shared that information. The president was livid. He wanted, when he saw our story, four heads to roll. And ultimately, he found some people to blame and ordered them fired, and they resigned. They weren't actually and didn't have any role in leaking information. But that's the kind of busting out quality this presidency prompts. People don't feel they can keep this counsel when they see the president putting the country at risk and putting our reputation as a world leader, knowledgeable, solid, rules-based, in jeopardy.
He said he knows better than these people about Putin, right? He knows better than the Secretary of State at the time. in his mind.
Yes. That's such a dramatic one for me too, because as told to me by multiple sources, you know, Rex Tillerson had literally spent hours one-on-one with Vladimir Putin when he was the CEO of ExxonMobil. He ran a company so much larger than Donald Trump's. You know, if you're going to compare size, Rex Tillerson is about 400 times the size of Donald Trump in terms of significance in leading a Fortune 100 company. He had been invited to come see Sochi, to see the Olympic city that Putin had built. He'd been invited out to Putin's personal yacht on the Black Sea for a luncheon of sturgeon and caviar. He tried to warn President Trump when he became Secretary of State that Vladimir Putin was an operator, KGB trained, incredibly strategic and smart, and woke up in the morning thinking, where is the White House and the U.S. vulnerable today? And can I go there and make it worse? President Trump basically told Tillerson, you're wrong. I don't believe that about Vladimir Putin. I mean, you've got to wonder, did Donald Trump conclude the best intentions of Vladimir Putin because he really wanted Trump to win the election? I don't know. But he rejected Tillerson's advice over and over again, to the point that, you know, again, on one of those secret calls where everyone's supposed to keep the president's counsel, they were again outraged to learn that the president was asking Vladimir Putin for advice about what to do in North Korea. It sort of strains credulity that Vladimir Putin is looking out for the best interests of the United States, and certainly in the Korean Peninsula.
And so people will leak things like that. Later in the book, in a little side note, when you're talking about whether Chris Christie would take the job of chief of staff, Trump leaks to Jonathan Carl, I guess, that he's going to, and admits it to Christie. And I thought it was just so interesting to see that Trump plays this game so boldly or baldly, and yet also can object to other people doing it.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, but that is a feature of the presidency in so many ways. You know, what he doesn't like other people doing, he's often doing. He went bananas criticizing Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee and one of the lead investigators of the impeachment inquiry. He went bananas in 2019 saying that Schiff was guilty of a crime, probably, or guilty of treason, that he should resign because he went to the floor and started to paraphrase in sort of a parody way President Trump's call with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. I think the president has to remember, but just ignores it for the purposes of that accusation, has to remember all the times he has misstated or parodied what someone else who's an enemy of his has said. It's just interesting about him. On the leak issue, I would just remind you that the president's goals are often about how he's perceived and how he markets, not necessarily the long-term decision or gain, but even the temporary gain for him personally. Remember, he was the guy calling gossip columnists, saying he was John Barron and that he had some information about how Donald Trump was dating some new sexy starlet and everybody wanted to date Donald Trump. It's sort of a strange thing to call reporters about, but it was important to him.
Now that you've seen Trump in action for these years, does it make you think differently about what qualifications we should look for in a president? When we're vetting people through the campaigns, when we're thinking about who to support, what do you think the core things now need to be given this new reality we live in?
Again, I'm a journalist, not a political advisor. And I also, just as a human being watching this unfold, can imagine there is some danger in setting new parameters or requirements for a president. I think the root problem in our country right now, and in Donald Trump's ability to convince a large section of the public that he's telling the truth when he's not, and that he's doing things for their betterment when he's not, I think the bigger problem in our country is the very dramatic level of anger among a large sector of our voting public, and a feeling that they've been left behind, mistreated by the political elite, dismissed, disregarded, ridiculed, and that they also are not making any effort to learn the facts. Because of their anger and distrust, they're not getting actual information. They've decided the mainstream media is making all of this up. And we have to address that, because it's civil war level division in the country right now. And the vigor with which people embrace falsehoods and conspiracies really frightens me. That's the core issue. And that is what informs how people choose their president. People chose Donald Trump because, and again, this will be a bold generalization, but people chose Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton represented that elitist, disregarding, full of baggage veteran who looked down her nose at the regular people. Her use of deplorables, as ill-advised as it was, captured what people thought she really felt. And Donald Trump was promising something new, but also old. He was promising people in some vague, vague way, a return to a halcyon day that probably never existed, but whatever was good that they remembered in the past, he was going to deliver it. He never said what it was, but he was going to give you that thing that you thought was good before about America.
I think one of the reasons that people came to that conclusion, to the extent they did, and I'm not sure that a loss in the popular vote fully tells that story, but one of the reasons I think they came to that conclusion was the way the coverage of the campaign in 2016 gave a lot of benefit to Trump, covered his rallies fully, gave him, some people have estimated, like $6 billion worth of free coverage, focused on the email story on Hillary's side in disproportion to probably its value. What do you think the press has learned from that coverage in 2016 that they might change or are changing as we approach 2020?
You know, I may anger listeners or supporters of Hillary Clinton by saying this, but I think that the email story was a completely valid and important story because, you know, in hindsight now, you see everything Donald Trump has done. You see all the norms he has busted. You see all the institutions he's weakened. You see all the rules he's driven a truck through. But if you take everybody back to 2016, making a private server for your emails so you don't have to share them with the public and follow the public records law was a big deal, and to my mind is still a very big deal. I don't regret anything that the Washington Post or the New York Times or anybody serious wrote about that. I do think that one of the things in the campaign that was problematic was that we were late to seizing upon and seeing the Russian interference in the election. That moment in June when the Democratic National Committee realizes they're being hacked, that was such an enormous story that we were slow to really grasp the importance of a foreign power trying to embarrass, harm, and cancel a Democratic candidate for president. That slowness was so critical because many reporters latched onto what they could tell authoritatively and factually and truthfully, which was, whoa, these emails are really interesting. This we have. the bigger story we were behind on. Now, the Democratic committee didn't exactly help because they were trying to handle this themselves and not sharing some of the details. But that bigger story about interference, if only we had hit that harder and sooner. But I have said that about so many stories in my lifetime. If only I'd grabbed it sooner and understood its importance. It just happened to be in that campaign. It was critically important to know that.
So you don't see the coverage in 2016 as being helpful to Trump in various ways that can be corrected?
You're going to cover both nominees. You're going to have White House reporters and campaign reporters out on the road with those two people nonstop. Donald Trump did put on quite a show. He was quite dramatic. He was incendiary. That does make news. You know, as I often say to friends, I don't write about planes that land safely on time. I write about the crashes. And Donald Trump was making quite a plane crash from time to time at his rallies. There was a lot of drama and fireworks. But we were covering Hillary Clinton's stumping as well. Because I wasn't personally involved in that, there may be reporters who are better suited to quarterback that than me. But watching it, I feel like the email reporting was appropriate. And though I didn't break that story, I wrote a lot about it afterwards, and I feel like that was the right call.
To me, it feels like there have been significant changes, even like CNN, you know, stopping the coverage of a rally or pointing out much more clearly in the middle of an article the lies that he's putting forward. When your editor talks to you, have there been like guidance to change at all? Or is it basically do the same things we've been doing?
At the Post, our editor, Marty Baron, wisely says there's no one size fits all for a story. There's no rule that we have to follow. We have to make judgments on a case-by-case basis. And there have been several times we have said that the president has told a falsehood. In fact, we have an entire book written by the Washington Post fact checker, Glenn Kessler, and his team, which chronicles how many times the president has said something that was false. We have to be careful, though, and I support the Post in this. We have to be careful to say the word lie, because lie is intention. We have to know that the president knows that what he's saying is not truthful when he says it, and he did it anyway. It's not a mistake. It's not a bluster. It's like he intended to tell a falsehood. So we use that sparingly. And there have been times when we knew it to be the case, and we said so. I could tell you many examples, but it would go on too long.
If you had to describe Trump's character after so carefully listening to 200 plus people talk about it, how would you describe it?
He is obsessed with his image. It is possibly more important to him than anything else. He is often lacking in an ability to take information from others who are experts. That is offensive to him often. I don't know what that personality trait is called, but I can't tell you how many times individuals who worked for him said they were dumbfounded to watch him recoil or snarl or just outright reject individuals whose job was to explain to him nuclear policy on the Korean Peninsula or the chemical weapons treaty or Putin's stake in Syria. And the president would become enraged or annoyed, something on that spectrum, but always unhappy to hear this information provided to him because he said, yeah, I know. I don't need to be told these things. And he would often go into an interrupting mode of telling them what he knew and why it was more important. That idea that a president, that presumption that a president won't take in information is really scary.
It has felt to me all along, probably other people as well, like what people might call waiting for the pivot. I keep waiting for him to listen to somebody else long enough to have a more enlightened long-term aim that will be successful for him. Like if he had handled the COVID crisis better, like many governors, his popularity would have risen dramatically like theirs did. And I'm kind of waiting still for him as we turn into the fall to get that under control, get a clear plan and kind of start to beat it in a way that uses the expertise available to him. But I guess the whole lesson of your book is he doesn't really do that, does he?
As I've been told often, people don't change their stripes after they're 40 or 50 years old, and the president's going to be the person he always was. I feel as though his niece, Mary Trump, sort of helps answer some of your question. This is a person who I have never heard from all the sources we talked to and from my own reporting. I've never heard him express regret or indicate that he was wrong by apologizing. I take that back. There is one time which was so stunning to me that he expressed regret for something, and that was in relationship to his brother, Frederick Trump, who, by his family's account, died of alcoholism that they viewed as sort of a suicide, misery, depression, alcoholism that was caused, according to the family, by the bullying and daily assault of his father and his brother, our current president. So this feature, you know, that Mary Trump, Frederick Trump's daughter, and Donald Trump's niece describe is that the president's been formed in a family that was very dysfunctional, shaped by a father who was abusive and used his son as a tool to accomplish the things he wanted to accomplish in his business, pitted brother against brother, Donald against Frederick, and vice versa. And that shaping of a person's psyche can kind of not be unwritten. And at his age, I think that would be very difficult for the pivot you describe.
Your book, which has done really well, it comes out, you got a tweet or two from Trump calling you and your co-author stone cold losers, which I don't think anything better could happen to an author that wants to sell a book. And I don't know how many interviews you've done. How many have there been?
I don't know either. I mean, a lot, but you know, it's
over 100.
Probably.
What has the reaction been like to you generally? What has it meant? And are you going to write another one? Because you sort of left off with that, perhaps before the biggest events of his presidency, as it turns out, perhaps, you know, COVID and impeachment and so on.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't agree with you more that the fourth year was the most consequential. The first three sort of presaged what was going to happen. In fact, that's one thing I'm really proud of about the book, that it has held up even in this incredibly newsy year, and it foreshadowed this, because so many of the sources who spoke to us said, you know, I fear what will happen when Donald Trump actually has a crisis. We are lucky we have not faced a crisis yet, because as they said, again, I'm paraphrasing them in one big conglomerate, but as they said, he often puts himself first, so a crisis will not be a place where he has a real toolkit to protect the country. And what comes along but a pandemic that he hopes to wish away because he worries it will spook the stock market. Well, it's done a lot more than that. It's killed nearly 150,000 people. Americans and put millions out of work. I'm going to take a breath for a minute just to say about the book. I'm really proud of it, not just because it's a tome of 400 plus pages of scenes that show you how Donald Trump operates, but I'm really proud of it because we held to a very high standard. Every story, every anecdote, every scene had to be vetted with multiple sources. People gave us their calendars, their diary entries, their email records to corroborate what they were telling us in person. And there were so many things we left on the cutting room floor because it didn't meet that standard. So while the facts are solid, another feature of the book also gives me a lot of pride, which is the narrative is easy to read. We went through a lot in those 3 years that were disappointing about the president's leadership. It is a story that is easy to follow and to understand what's happening. And we take you behind the scenes of things that we thought we had reported well in the paper. We thought we had captured them in a full and accurate way. When Phil and I went back to scrape to see what else there was a lot. And there was so much more nuance and complexity that we were able to bring to the book. In terms of the president's reaction, you know, you're right, him calling us stone cold losers was probably good for us.
A little scary.
A little bit. But he's called me a lowlife and third rate and all those things before. I will note that while he made those insults, he disputed nothing in the book, not one fact.
Well, it seems unlikely that he read it.
Well, he read the coverage of it. He read the...
That's what he does. Yeah. He's watched the coverage more likely.
Well, correct. Whichever it is, he knows what the important news developments were from the book. Notably that he didn't know really what happened at Pearl Harbor, that he made up an excuse to avoid going to an important reverential ceremony to honor U.S. soldiers, that he excoriated people filming him when he messed up in reading the Constitution. He surely read those highlights from the news coverage.
I will agree with you fully that it is very readable and that it really carries a theme through its many anecdotes. Did you know at the outset that theme and things fit it, or did that develop as you investigated?
Well, absolutely the latter. We began the reporting in earnest as we set out to sort of figure out what's the story we're going to tell, what's important about this presidency, what's historic, what's... And there were a lot of books that had been written about Donald Trump. Bob Woodward, our wonderful colleague, you know, really like the mark of covering a president. His book had told a lot of really interesting stories, and he'd done it well. There were more salacious ones, which, you know, people can debate whether those were as accurate as they should have been, but there were plenty of salacious books relaying certain scenes. So we needed to find our own scenes, and then we needed to figure out what does that reporting tell us? Just like a good story, you can't go in assuming you know how it's going to end and what your frame is. You have an idea, a theory, and you test it with your reporting. I have to also give a lot of credit to a person that I now view with such reverence, and that's the editor of our book, Anne Godoff at Penguin Press, because she worked with us as we came back with the reporting. We would have these sort of story editor sessions and just talk through for an hour what we'd learned, what we were seeing. And in many ways, she's the one who gave us the architecture, the scaffolding. We had the facts, and she said, here's what I see you telling me about this guy. Here's what I hear over and over again in the stories you've brought back. And she was dead right.
I mean, you said, I remember in your thanks to her, that she schooled you in teleology, mm-hmm. which is the explanation of phenomena in terms of the purpose they serve rather than the cause by which they arise. Is that what you're saying there?
I think so. Although I have to be honest and tell you that when she first said that word to me, I was like, what the heck is she saying? And I didn't want to immediately admit I didn't know that word. But yes, and also this idea of scaffolding was important to us. Like, we can tell you about a president who did a lot of things in foreign and domestic spheres that were troubling. But we feel like the newspaper tells you that quite a bit. Everybody felt like they knew, I shouldn't say that, readers of the Washington Post certainly must have felt that they were getting a full buffet of information about what President Trump did from day to day. And in fact, he made himself quite available in news conferences, in his Twitter feed, to tell you what was on his mind in an uncensored way. Sure, sometimes he was gilding it and exaggerating it, but he was telling people on a regular basis, here's what's going on. We've discovered in our reporting behind those scenes what was motivating him, what he was telling people in real time about what he was trying to accomplish. And that psyche of the man was something new we could bring to the table. And it was the spine. Who is he? What makes him tick?
A good part of the plot is about the Mueller investigation and the kind of success that Trump has in getting around it, in knocking it down and coming out in the end with an attorney general who delivers the news of it in such a way that Trump can claim complete exoneration. There was a hint in an interview that the Post did with you and your co-author about the part about collusion. They didn't say they found real evidence. Then you were surprised and that you knew more about collusion than was in that report. What do you know, or what do you think about Trump and collusion with Russia?
Well, Mueller luckily has added to the record on this recently when the president decided to commute the sentence of Roger Stone in recent weeks. A Friday night, by the way, which always makes reporters crazy because it means you're trying to bury some story. But
seems like every Friday has somebody being some inspector general going down. But yes.
Yes, there's quite a lot of that. So Mueller's addition to the record is useful. He reminds people that Roger Stone did not answer a lot of their questions and lied to Congress about his knowledge of Russian interest in hacking these emails. You may remember that we never really got a straight story, even in the investigation, of what Roger Stone knew and why he seemed to know in the spring of 2016 about emails that would be embarrassing to Hillary Clinton. That is still unresolved and was not entirely revealed by Mueller's investigation. But there were a lot of clues to suggest that Stone was talking to candidate Donald Trump and to others in the campaign about this forthcoming information that was going to be very bad for Hillary and very helpful to Donald Trump. Well, there were only two players involved in this, and that was a Russian intelligence operation and Julian Assange. The Russians were hacking these emails, piercing these servers, and then sharing it with Assange to disseminate. The other thing that I find interesting about this episode is the candidate's own words at the time. You'll remember a campaign event in Doral where the president famously said, "Russia, if you're listening." What Mueller revealed, he said basically, Donald Trump said he'd love to get copies of the 33,000 private emails that Hillary Clinton deleted and never turned over to the State Department on the argument that they were personal. He disputed whether she had been honest about that. What's funny is Mueller found out And in fact, a member of his team found out with great excitement that minutes after Donald Trump made that pronouncement in Doral, those Russian intel officers, those hackers, went back to work. It was nighttime, dinner time in Moscow, but they went back to work basically for Donald Trump per his request.
That's when hackers work, that's all.
It's possible.
Carol, is there a question that you've never been asked about this book that you wish you had been asked after all these interviews?
No. Everybody's asked me pretty much everything, I think. I feel really grateful that I was able to find such a great colleague in Phil Rucker. We have a lot of complementary skills. He was a wonderful partner in this project. And I feel really grateful that we were able to bring this information to the public and that it received such a warm response from readers and book buyers. That was just so affirming to have people enjoy the book and feel that they learned something from it too.
Well, I feel grateful that you took the time to talk to me today about this. Anything else you want to say?
Nothing except thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Carol Lenig. She's at Carol Lenig on Twitter. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.